In 2007, I had one of the craziest experiences of my entire life. I was working at the Comedy Store as a doorman, and a comedian told me that I should go and audition to play Shrek in the Shrek musical on Broadway. And I gotta tell you, Jack, I was pretty insulted, okay? I was like, what about me makes you think that I don't answer
I think it's okay. I think it's your green skin.
You think it's my green skin?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. So I went to this open call audition for Shrek the Musical. I ended up getting a callback, and then I ended up doing 32 more callbacks over a period of 3 months.
Oh, wow.
Getting to work with Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen and Sam Mendes and all these amazing people that were part of the audition process, which was very intense for me because I'd never had any sort of real success in my career at that point.
That's amazing.
It was crazy. I ended up getting cast to play Shrek on Broadway. I ended up moving from my crappy apartment here in Los Angeles to a high-rise apartment overlooking Central Park.
Wow.
It was one of the most incredible places I've ever lived. And every day I would get a car service would come pick me up and take me to 42nd Street, and I would get to work with the biggest stars on Broadway. It was absolutely amazing until right before the show opened and they fired me.
Oh shit.
Because they had a big Broadway star that they were training secretly to take over the part. And that ends up actually being pretty common practice on Broadway. They constantly have newbie people that are talented come in, work out a role, get it to where they want it to be, and then fire them right before the show opens and replace them with a star that suddenly becomes available. And I didn't know that. It was heartbreaking. But
I mean, when you said it was heartbreaking, right? You said it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So what happened? What did you do?
Well, I was very, very depressed. I moved back to Los Angeles, kind of, tail between my legs, so embarrassed, and just felt like everyone thought I was a giant failure for not actually getting to do the job that everyone knew that I'd been cast to do. And I was back here for a few weeks when I got an audition to be one of the stars of a show on Nickelodeon. That show ended up going and ran for 5 years, and it was this massive hit. And I mean, if I wouldn't have had this horrible experience on Broadway, this big failure on Broadway, then I would have never gotten to experience what it's like to star on a TV show.
I'm Jack Hergith.
And I'm Stephen Kramer Glickman.
And this is Never Surrender,
the show where we sit down with the most successful people in the entertainment industry to talk about failure and how they pushed through it and never gave up.
Because we've all failed. We've all had setbacks.
Yeah, we've all questioned whether to keep going.
But at some point, everybody struggles.
Yeah, I mean, I've been let go from some of my favorite jobs.
You and me both. We just hope that by listening to this podcast, it will help give you the strength to never surrender.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This guest is an iconic comedian who has been through hell and back.
She's written and starred in her own show, One Mississippi, released a number of comedy specials, including Boyish Girl Interrupted, which earned her an Emmy and Grammy nomination. She also released a 2018 Netflix documentary called Tig, which is all about her life.
Even after getting diagnosed with breast cancer in 2012 and feeling her life and career were over, she kept going. She is the definition of never surrendering.
This is Tig Notaro.
I'm so excited because our guest today is a phenomenal, phenomenal stand-up comedian and an actress and someone that I care deeply for. Tig Notaro, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yay!
We're so excited.
Standing ovation.
We're both standing.
We're standing in the booth.
Yeah, we're
we're standing inside
the tiny
booth.
Yes.
I know. Thank you for taking some time away to from your family. You have kids.
I do. They're at a fun age.
Sure.
But I've heard the new term of three-nagers.
Oh, okay.
Which is it's pretty accurate.
I like that. I like that term.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
They're you know, getting ideas and thoughts and feelings that are they're having their own mind is
sowing their oats at three, sort of like pushing boundaries and all that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I have nine-agers, I guess.
Uh-huh. And how are they?
They were swearing at each other in the car this morning, which is interesting when you hear words come out of a 9-year-old's mouth.
Yeah. I got my mouth washed out with soap once.
Really?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It wasn't fun.
Uh-huh.
It felt very 70s. I feel like maybe even in the moment I was like, this feels like we're in the 70s.
Did it happen in the 70s or did it happen
It
recently?
Happened in the 70s.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, yeah.
And I was like, well, this feels like it's happening in the right decade.
Were you a good kid or kind of a bad kid?
I mean, I was mischievous. I was the class clown. I was up to stuff. But, you know, I never got into drugs or I was never really doing. I mean, I was both, you know.
Yeah.
I smoked cigarettes.
Really?
At 6 and 8?
And failed 3 grades.
You did?
Dropped out of high school.
That's something that there's you never know. The internet, you know, says things.
Yeah.
And so you're never sure if the internet is right. But it somewhere on the internet, it said that you had failed 8th grade.
Well, I failed 3 grades.
You
I failed 8th grade
grades.
Twice.
Really?
And then I failed 9th grade.
Oh, wow.
God, what?
How did you, what went into you failing 8th and 9th grade?
Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Uh-huh. I just went into school. I mean, it's funny because, and this is another thing, I drove a motorcycle, but always, I never took lessons. I didn't have a license. And then as an adult, I thought, well, I should get my motorcycle license. And I went to class and I was sitting there and it came over me again, just sitting in motorcycle class where I was like, I hate school. And so I just bailed.
Did you fail motorcycle class?
I dropped out.
Oh, wow.
I dropped out of motorcycle school.
Oh, geez.
Was your family okay with what was happening or were you just like, who cares? Like what?
I was kind of who cares?
Yeah.
But I cared. I didn't want them to disapprove, but I also couldn't take it. And so, a really good friend of mine, who my mother just adored, dropped out of high school, and he was the opposite, where he had 4.0 SAT scores through the perfect scores. And he dropped out, and I think that made my mother okay when I dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah.
Did she say, now you have to get a job now, or, was she strict about it, or?
Not really. My mother wasn't very strict, and I wanted to get a job. I didn't relate to go to school, go to college, get married, move to suburbia. I just wasn't really on that trajectory.
Did that kick in early? Was there do you remember the first time where you were like, oh, this is, I'm not going that path?
I don't think I knew it. I don't think I was completely aware. I think I was just always looking around thinking, what are these people doing? What are people following here? I was just really into, music and smoking cigarettes and hanging out with friends and riding a motorcycle.
That's really cool. I mean, you were a much cooler kid than me.
But you said you were, to go back to what you were saying earlier, you said you were into music.
Did you, want to be in a band and be performing live as a musician?
Yeah. In my head, I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. But in, you know, my heart and soul, I had this rattling around of loving comedy. Mm-hmm. And I really, it was exhilarating to me to see comedians on stage in theaters. And I would always baffle me. I didn't understand when I would see Paula Poundstone or Robin Williams or Ellen or somebody walk out on HBO and they're in a full theater. I was like, how'd you get all those people there? Because I understood with music, you have airplay and all that kind of stuff. But how do people know? How do you just walk out on a theater and everyone's cheering and then you tell jokes and you head out?
Right.
And yeah. So I thought, oh, I want to do that. But I didn't understand how to get from A to B or C or anywhere.
Right.
And yeah. So I just thought, well, I guess that I won't be doing that. And then I just was a bit aimless from the time I dropped out until I started stand-up. I played, and the other problem was I was too shy to play music on stage. I did it a few times, but I was so uncomfortable. I was shaking. I couldn't play my guitar. So I realized I was more of a private, you know, at home musician.
Were you? Mm-hmm. Did you consider like working on the other side of it in music management?
Or, I did. Or, that's
did
what
you
I
do
did.
That?
Yeah, I worked in the music industry, and I thought that that was fulfilling me. And until I finally tried stand up, yeah, and then I was like, yeah, "That's hilarious!" That I thought anything was fulfilling me, and then I was just off and running doing stand up 7 nights a week.
So, what motivated you from being a music manager and working in industry to like, okay, I'm finally going to go up on stage. I'm going to try this comedy thing.
My close friends that I grew up with, they had gone to high school and college and had aspirations. And so they were actually going to school and looking for jobs. And I just followed them around wherever they went, wherever they moved, whatever college they got into. The three of us just...
So you were not employed at this point?
I'd work at, you know, work for a record label. I'd work at a coffee shop. I'd do, you know, different stuff. I worked with kids. My friends moved out to Los Angeles to get into TV and film. And so I thought, well, sure, I'll go there. There's music there. And sleeping on their couch and started looking through the LA Weekly and saw these open mics. And you know, in so many other cities, you would have the main club, whether it was an improv or Funny Bone or something like that. And then maybe an open mic at those places or someplace, but usually not. And now there's, after the alternative comedy explosion, people started independently producing comedy shows and open mics. And so there, you can go into so many different towns and cities and there's options. But at the time I didn't really see those options, and it was intimidating in other cities that I was living in or visiting. Whereas when I got out to Los Angeles and I saw the opportunity, I immediately, 2 weeks after moving here, started doing open mics.
Wow. What was the first place you went?
I went to actually perform or to...
Yeah,
okay,
to do stand-up.
To do stand-up was... there was a coffee shop in West Hollywood called Little Frida's.
Sure.
And it was known as a lesbian coffee shop, but which is hilarious. It's like, what does that mean? But... But yeah, so they had a weekly stand-up night, all female lineup, and so I got up on stage there, and I had been talking to myself in my apartment for the 2 weeks leading up to the show and hadn't accounted for laughs, which seems odd.
Yeah.
Because I was just trying to get through my material and memorize it all, and then I got on stage and I got some laughs, and I was taken aback. I was like, oh, gosh, that scared me.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And then, you know, I just kept doing it.
But it gave you the confidence to keep going, like, hey, I can do this.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I'd do it and not be able to do it. And then I'd do it, and then I'd do it, and it'd go okay, and then it'd go terribly. And be horribly embarrassed one night and then feel like I was the greatest comedian ever to walk the planet the next night. And I think that's that crazy relationship with it is the back and forth. And I started to feel like if 51% of the time I'm doing okay, then I feel like there's enough to go on.
I read somewhere that the first time you got paid to do stand-up, you got fired halfway through that first week.
Correct.
And what was that like for you?
It was painful.
Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
It was in Denver. I had gone to Denver, and a friend of mine's father is kind of, he came up with Roseanne Barr in Denver in the 80s. And, like they both were neck and neck as the funniest person in Denver.
Oh, wow.
Like really from that world. And he let me do a guest spot for like 5 minutes at one of his shows. And when I got off stage, the club was like, oh, you know, that was great. We're going to book you to come back and you can MC for a whole week. And of course, terrible money, but like go out on the road and get maybe $350 to MC for a week.
Oh, yeah.
And then stay at the comedy condo and they give you a comedy car. And it's like,
oh,
wow.
God.
And I was just so excited. And then that club shut down. And then this other club took over the bookings of the club that booked me. And then I was out at this strip mall bombing and more bombing.
Oh my
and then
God.
The next show and bombing and bombing. And I was like, oh, my God. And I also didn't realize at the time I wasn't really a host. I didn't know how to MC. I just knew how to, like, get up on stage and tell my jokes. I was very much into just the written verbal element of comedy. There was no real performance. I was, you know, they would say, okay, here's the fishbowl. You know, get people's business cards and give away a free drink and ask whose birthday it is. And my delivery was like,
oh no.
I was like, are there any birthdays tonight? Like, it truly was just, I was so, whereas now I could do it in my own way that was making fun of it and really doing it, and I would know how to embrace it as my own. But at the time, I was truly just standing up there holding a fishbowl. It was just a nightmare. Friends of mine, because I had lived in Denver, they had all come to the show to see me. I got fired between the early and late show.
Oh, no.
So I did the early show. All my friends were coming to the late show. It was incredible. Somebody from the venue was running around saying, has anyone seen the emergency fill-in comedian? And I thought, oh, my God, did something happen to Nancy, who was the opening act, mm-hmm. to the feature? And I didn't know that I had caused the emergency I was being replaced. And so the guy came up and he gave me my money and he was like, you don't work at my club. And I was like, oh, God. And he gave me the money and he was like, skedaddle. And so I was leaving and my friends were in line to get into the late show.
Oh no.
It was so horrifying.
Oh, no.
I didn't think I was gonna live through this.
And did you just like kind of like sulk off to the side so your friends wouldn't see you, or were like, hey everybody?
They were like, hey, we're so excited to see you. And I was like, oh, come here. And I said, I just got fired. And they were like, no way.
No.
And I was like, yeah, I did.
Oh,
I
my
fired.
God.
Did you think about like, oh, maybe I'm not great?
Oh, for sure. I thought that I had gotten that answer. I thought real comedy was you get out on the road and you're in a comedy club on the road. And I just kept thinking, okay, I've been pampered by the LA scene and that's not real. And mm-hmm. I really went out to do a club and I got real money and I failed and I'm a fraud. And so it was mortifying. And my friend Nancy, who became my friend, Nancy Norton, who's an incredible comedian in the Denver Boulder area. Well, anywhere she goes, but yeah. She lives in that area. She was the feature comedian and she was pulling into the parking lot and she said, where are you going? I said, I just got fired. And she said, no. And every night after I would bomb, she would come up to me and she'd be like, oh my God, you are so funny. And I thought she was messing with me. Mm-hmm. You know, Yeah. I would just be like, oh, thanks. And but she, in the parking lot, she was like, no way. And I said, why do you think I'm heading out to the parking lot at showtime when you're arriving? And she was like, oh my gosh. She said, these people, they don't get you. She said, this, and be glad they don't get you. Mm-hmm. And she said, they get me so much, and that's my own problem, and I'll deal with that another time. But be glad that they don't get you.
Oh, I love that.
And then she said, I can get you on stage in the like premier club in downtown Denver. And she did. And the audience was so much better.
Oh, right.
Than,
that's so
like,
nice.
In like just way out of downtown Denver in a strip in a strip mall. And you know, I don't mean to knock the club. I was just really not at any place to be. You know, they were basing it on a 5-minute set, and then, like I said, the club closed down. And but I feel like I could get through hosting at a strip mall club. Wow.
There's crazy. Something about so sometimes you see a comic and it kind of makes you go like, oh my God, what is this? What am I even doing? Like, is there someone like that for you?
Yeah.
When you saw them and it just blew your mind?
At moments when I've thought that I hit my stride, I'll see somebody like Maria Bamford and I'll be like, that's, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I need to pack it up and go home.
Right.
Because, I mean, that's, I just feel like that's the, that's top notch, pinnacle. And, but yeah, I feel like there's different moments of feeling like you hit your stride and yeah.
Yeah.
There's no particular moment.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, cause I read somewhere that your process in constructing a joke is that, or material is that you don't really write anything out. You kind of write ideas out and then you go test them on the stage.
Yeah.
One of my favorite bits that you've ever done is the Taylor Dayne bit. And I saw you do that, I think, at Hollywood Forever, like years and years ago, and around town several times. I'm just curious, like, how did you go about testing that out? And at what point were you like, okay, this is a solid, amazing bit?
Well, first of all, thank you. It was one of the hardest pieces I've ever written because... if you listen to the beginning of the story, there's really not any, there's not a joke for a while. I'm just setting it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was first, when it was a 25-minute story, it would intimidate me because there's, the setup is so long. It really took me maybe 6 months to get it down to 15 minutes where I knew, where I started naturally adding in the "you are not going to believe" and all those little moments of trying to trigger people, you know, like this is anyway. And it was also a bit that because it was so long and if it wasn't going well, I would be out on a limb and I would still have 10 more minutes to go. And they're already not into it.
Right. I was going to ask you because, like, it could go either way, right, depending on your audience.
Yes. Yeah. And, in fact, there's a version of it online that I did for Conan. And it was right at the... it was in the middle of my stuff that I was going through in 2012. And I was...
stop it.
I was being filmed... and my brain just went away, and I forgot the story.
Oh, no.
And the audience was laughing because they thought I was kidding, and I was saying, I know you think I'm kidding right now, and I really don't remember the story, and it's actually true. And I said, yes. Oh, my gosh. I'm completely blanking on what happens next in this story that I've told a few times. So Taylor Dayne says, wait, guys, I'm blanking.
This is hilarious. You guys are thinking this is a joke, but it's not. You're like, wow, you've already built an awkward situation. So certainly this is part of the bit. It's not.
And then they were laughing. It was so uncomfortable, but I finally got through it. And then I went backstage. The producer came up to me and he said, hey, listen, don't worry. We can edit that and we can make it look this way. And I was in such a bad place in life that I said, you know what? Don't edit it. I kind of want that just out there. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. And I want people to see me struggling through it. I would want to see that.
Right.
You know, I'd be fascinated to see somebody struggling like that.
Yeah.
And it's out there. And somebody wrote a piece about that particular set saying they felt like I was toying with the audience. And I was not toying with the audience. I really was just in the middle of like...
just some shit.
Yeah. A lot. I didn't even know I had cancer yet.
More with Tig Notaro after this break.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So 2012 is like the worst year of all years. It's got to be a pretty bad. That's a rough year for you. I mean,
it was definitely rough.
Mother of pearl.
Yeah.
You were hospitalized for some problem.
I had pneumonia. I thought I had a cold, and the last time I talked to my mother, she told me to have orange juice And I didn't know I had pneumonia. I just kept telling friends that I had plans with, oh, can we get coffee tomorrow? I'm sure I'll feel better. I just kept trying to push things a little more. And then, anyway, I ended up having pneumonia. They gave me antibiotics for the pneumonia. And then my body had an adverse response to the antibiotics. And what can happen, which happened to me, is the antibiotics cleared out all the bacteria in my gut.
All the good bacteria, yeah, right?
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, and maybe, I guess, bad, just everything. Like, it's called C. diff, and it's a bacteria that lives in your gut. Like, most people have it,
right,
and it's fine if it's working with the other bacteria, but this alone, thriving without anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Just grows and eats away at your
C. difficile.
Yeah,
yeah.
Your insides,
it's
utterly horrendous. And so I was hospitalized for that, and then I was released from the hospital. And a couple of days later, my mother fell and hit her head and was not conscious. And I had to fly home and take her off life support.
Oh, jeez.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
And then when I got home, well, to my mother's house, I was too sick because even though I had tested negative for C. diff, the damage it had done to my insides, and mm-hmm. it was hard for me to eat. And I was too sick to leave, so I stayed at her house for probably, I think it was a month, month and a half. And then, you know, there's the funeral. And then I left and I went to New York to do This American Life, which was another version of Taylor Dayne. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the first little bit of hope I got, because when I got off stage, Ira Glass was like, we got one of the biggest responses from that story. What story do you want to do next? We want to have you on the show again immediately. And I said, well, I just got diagnosed with invasive cancer, and I don't really feel like telling a story. I'm in a rough spot. Because he knew I had gone through all the other stuff and made my way to New York.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and then I did that Taylor Dayne story on This American Life. I go home. My girlfriend and I split up, and then I'm diagnosed with cancer.
Oh,
this was all in 4 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was really intense, and to say the very least. And then I went on stage. I had a booked show at Largo.
Right.
And the owner, Flanagan, just said, listen, just keep it on the books in case you want to do it. And if not, we'll cancel it the second you, like, decide not to do it. Like, 2 seconds before showtime, you can cancel it. And I was like, you're insane.
Did they know at this point that you had cancer?
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone knew. Oh. And Ira, I had told I had cancer. And he said, you should talk about it on stage and talk about everything you've been through. And I was like, you're insane. Flanagan, who owns Largo, is insane. Everybody is insane. I just am in a bad place.
Right, right.
And then I went on stage and I talked about it and had Largo record it. And then the show went, you know, well enough as far as I was concerned. And then I emailed Ira Glass in the middle of the night and I said, hey, I talked about everything and I'll send you something. Maybe you could find something in there to use. And then I went to bed, turned my phone off, and I woke up the next day, and that show, there were 4 or 5 comedians that were on that show, and they were all tweeting, and the audience was tweeting and blogging, and I wasn't on Twitter, I wasn't on anything. I was just alone. I was just home sleeping, and then I woke up to truly book deal offers, and
wow.
I woke up to every major publication wanting to talk to me, Rolling Stone magazine.
My God.
And my mailbox was full on my phone. I had 50 or more emails, and it's hard to imagine that I wasn't on Twitter. I was so removed.
Right, right.
That I really, it was like your great, great grandmother. I didn't understand how everybody knew. I thought I was just sharing something with the 300 people in Largo.
Uh-huh.
Sure, of course, right. Yeah.
And then I thought, well, you know, maybe one day I'll die from this and then people will hear through the grapevine, oh, she died. I heard that she had cancer. That's right. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about, you know, the recording of Live and sort of where your mindset was, because there was a year, a couple of years ago, where I got fired from my job.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple months later, my mom died.
Mm-hmm.
And then 6 weeks later, my dad died.
Oh, my God.
And then a few months after that, I got diagnosed with cancer. So I know what it's like to live through, like, tragedy that just keeps happening over and over and over again, and you're like, when is this ever going to
and what was the time span
let
out? Of all that,
it was about a year.
Uh-huh.
Like, all that, like, happened within a year.
Oh my gosh.
And this was the second time I had gotten cancer. It was two different types, and I was just like, I was about to lose it. And then I had to have surgery.
Uh-huh.
And then after the surgery, 6 weeks later, I'm getting this horrible pain in my bladder. I'm like, what the hell? And I was like, turns out I had this delayed allergic reaction. And it was the most pain I'd ever had in my life. And I remember telling my wife, if this doesn't stop, I'm going to fucking jump off the roof.
Yeah.
Because it was so awful.
Yeah.
So I look back on that and I think, like, you know, like, people say, well, how did you get through all it? Through all of that. And I think, I don't know. Like, I just got up every day and I went through it. So, you know, my question to you is, like, how did you get through all that? Is the first question. And the second question is, what in your mind made you say, I'm going to go up on stage, go to Largo and do a whole set? Like, where is your mind at? Like, are you scared? Are you freaked out? Like, I'm just like,
yeah.
I just commend you for doing it, just knowing that I've been in that space.
Well, I'm very sorry for what you went through.
Oh.
I do know what a lot of pain feels like, and emotional and physical.
Sure.
And it's, it's a lot. And so it's intense. And as far as doing that show in 2012, I was nervous mainly because I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, because I realized in the shower before the show that I was going to open the set with, hello, good evening, I have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that one little moment that could be out there hurting somebody's feelings, of them thinking I'm making light of cancer, if they're going through it or one of their loved ones. But then I had to just go, I'm going to reveal my story because I do have cancer. And
right,
I just
right.
have to. So I was very nervous about that. And I was also nervous because I knew it might be a terrible set. It might not be funny. It might not be interesting or compelling in any way. And I might just be wasting everyone's money, and they've gotten babysitters, and I know what it takes to, you know, it's hard. People save money, they get babysitters, they make a night of it, and I'm like, hey, good evening, I have cancer.
Right.
Give me your money.
Right.
So those things were in my head of, I care that I do a good show. I care that people have a good time. But, you know, I do love doing stand-up, and I felt like I had just watched life go away very quickly with losing my mother, with accidentally falling, and then having my own. I didn't know what I was in for. I didn't know what was to come. So I just, having these different illnesses back to back, I was like, well, I probably am going to die. And it was so piled on the other that I couldn't imagine I was going to live, because I had just seen death really closely.
Sure.
So, I think that I love doing stand-up, and so I wanted to do it. And I also was scared it was going to be my last time to do it, so I really wanted to do it.
Right.
And I really wanted to talk about what I was actually going through, and just take that chance. And I've felt like in life, with my personal life and my career, anytime I take a chance, I rarely regret it, you know?
Right, I love that.
It's very rare where I'm like, I shouldn't have really gone big there.
You know? What's an amazing thing is, by you doing that, you did something that I tell comedians and friends in our weird little circles of people, is that when you are going through something,
mm-hmm.
it's better if you can let people know that you're going through something.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a relief that you're not living it on your own in the dark.
Well, and that's how I would have done it. Because before I was diagnosed with cancer, I was very private and withholding, and don't come this close, and don't, I was very shut off in ways, and distant in ways, and I remember calling my manager and saying, I don't want anybody to know that I'm going through this, and just this is going to be just between me and you. And he was like, absolutely. And we were just trying to figure out how to just hunker down and go through this. And I was like, I want to keep working. I want to keep, I had that bit of fear of people would maybe steer away because,
mm-hmm,
that's not a reliable person to book. But I felt that way. And then and getting that diagnosis, I was kind of at the end of my at the end of the rope. And I was just like, I don't care. I don't care about anything in the most releasing kind of way. Like, right. I have lost everything. Mm-hmm. I've lost everything.
Right.
Okay.
What do you have to lose?
Yeah. Okay. Right? So yeah. This show doesn't go well. How hilarious. I do a, like right. a drop a bomb and then I die. You know,
like, that's the lady who died right after she did that
show.
Yeah.
Right. Like she made everyone sad and uncomfortable and then she disappeared and died.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, you know, that's kind of funny in its own way.
What was the reaction from the audience when you're out stage saying, hello, good evening, I have cancer?
And they like, were laughing nervously. Uh-huh. And I had a podcast for several years and people had been hearing my podcast and I, you know, they knew I had been sick with pneumonia and C. diff and that my mother had died and I'd gone to the funeral and now I broke up with my girlfriend. And so they were hearing through this podcast what was going on. And then I also had said the week before, they found this lump. They think maybe it's cancer. And everybody's like, all my co-hosts are like, oh, no way. No. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm sure it's not, you know. But
and not after all this.
Yeah. Right. And so I did this. And then I got my diagnosis. And I went and did my set. And people from that listened to the podcast were at the show. And I heard later from different listeners that they were very upset because they had been following my story.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people that didn't listen to the podcast were like, okay, where's she going with this?
Right.
And it turned into just a constant stream of laughter, crying. I mean, I was watching people cry from the audience. It was really bizarre.
I'm now very thrilled, and it is my great privilege to bring to the stage someone who is a very, very dear friend who I love and cherish, and you do too, of course. I'm talking about Tig Notaro.
Yeah.
Hello. Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God.
I was just watching people shake their heads and also just watch me, not smile, not cry, just listen. Yeah. It was a real mix, and I had to just kind of let go of expectations of comedy and shows and just be like, this is... I felt very held up by that audience, and I run into people every now and then where they're like, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's intense when I meet them.
Ooh, I bet.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you walked off stage? Like,
I felt good.
Uh-huh.
I felt good. I felt like... Well, that's the best I could have done. And I didn't think it was going to get a Grammy nomination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the album ended up becoming the number one selling comedy album of the year, like around the world.
Huge.
It was very
big. Huge, huge album.
And I didn't expect that. I truly believe that I feel like I'm good. But
right.
Who knows?
Sure.
But I feel like the lesson I learned from that chunk of time stays with me, and I'm thankful for it. I'm so thankful to be alive. I'm so changed by the experiences that I've had, and I'm so just eager to be done with these hospitalizations.
Oh, I know.
I cannot wait to be not like negligent carefree, but I just want to be out there in the world and not like, oh God, but I'm very devoted to my diet. I'm devoted to moving my body every day. I don't take it for granted. And, cause I've seen it really, really slip away. And so I'm going on almost a decade of like, oh, this and that, and I'm in the hospital again. I got this surgery and this complication. And now I'm just like, all right, let's get through this.
Right.
And
right.
I am I'm gone. You will not. I am going to be doing things that I have not ever done before. I'm so excited.
Like, what kind of things do you want
to
do?
Probably just play the harmonica.
get a pig, right?
Yeah, get a pig. Yeah.
On a train.
Go get a pig.
Just ride the rails. Yeah. Just ride the rails and play the harmonica.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Yeah, why not?
Ride the rails.
I would happily ride the rails.
I don't know who else plays
pig.
A harmonica.
Bob Dylan.
Oh, so I'm so sorry.
Bruce Springsteen. Chrissy Hine. Stevie Wonder.
All right, fine.
So many people.
I want to talk about a few things real quick before we wrap up. One Mississippi, your show that you did, is so brilliant so funny. What was that like for you to put a show like that together and to star on a show and make a thing?
You know, there were difficult elements, with the, producing element of it.
Okay.
But it was, exactly the story I wanted to tell and how I wanted to tell it. It was nice to take the seed of my story of what had happened in 2012 and then go in different directions and kind of follow my story where I didn't know where it was going to go and just create storylines or take from people that were in the writer's room. I mean, a lot of it is I would say 75% of it is my story.
Yeah.
But it was, I feel very proud of it. And when it ended, the way it ended after season two, and then they canceled it, I was like, I'm good with that.
You know, being that you have gone through what you have gone through, you know, there are people who may be listening out there who are struggling through things either personally, professionally, like, is there some sort of any sort of advice you could give to them, you know, through what you've gone through? Like,
no.
Okay.
No, I mean, it's, I wrote a book about what I went through. And in that book, I was kind of just searching for that answer. And I felt like what I kept coming back to and what I wrote about is just the simplest thing, which is I'm embarrassed to share this because it's like, yeah, no duh. But to keep taking steps, to always move forward, to keep some momentum going, not kill yourself over it, but, you know, like you were talking about, you couldn't stand up. I mean, keep going and set different markers for yourself and just that it really is. It's just that's what I thought about every day when I went through what I was going through is to just move a step further.
Yeah.
And related but unrelated. What I do like to share with people that has changed my life, and it's a quote I read somewhere and I tweaked it because it was like to the best gift a parent can give a child is a well-lived life of their own. But I feel like just tweaking it to the best gift you can give anyone is a well-lived life of your own. Mm-hmm. And I think about that all the time, and it's so true. And if you take care of yourself and you do your best and you just live your life to the fullest and healthiest and best way you can, nobody's going to be, you know, bummed out or worried about you or
right.
If you're out there living.
Yeah.
It's just the greatest thing you can do. And I think about it all the time. And that's what I tell everybody. I didn't think about that to get through my stuff, but think about it every day. Like, I gotta grow. I gotta change. I gotta take care of myself. I gotta, you know, be alive and live.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
Well,
I can't think of a better way to end this.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tig, for
thought we were just getting started. And I'd say go get a pig. Yeah, go get a pig.
Yeah.
You bet.
Never Surrender is produced by Western Sound.
Executive producers are Jack Herga, Stephen Kramer Glickman, and Ben Adair. Producers are Sabrina Fang and Cameron Kell. Music by Hannes Brown.
On social media, you can check us out on Instagram at NeverSurrenderPod, on Twitter at SurrenderPod, and on Facebook at NeverSurrenderPodcast. You can also email us at NeverSurrenderPodcast@gmail.com to share your own stories about how you struggled, failed, and ultimately never surrendered.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.